Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Retro Rankings Podcast, brought to you by Potation Rotation. I am your host, Paul. This podcast is a platform to rank the top 7 best or worst of anything video game related, retro to now, according to me. Being that these lists are of my opinion, of course, leaves things open for debate, and if you wish to do so, please visit us on social media or email us at potationrotation@gmail.com. And let me tell you something, today is a haphazardly continuation of the last episode in which we discussed the top 7 Sonic the Hedgehog games of all time. And I kind of said, well, I kind of want to keep playing some Sega games. I'm kind of in a Sega, retro Sega mood as of late. And so I wanted to do a top 7 Sega Genesis games of all time list. However, the caveat was that there was not going to be any Sonic games in that list. And I'll tell you, it definitely made this a whole lot harder. Now, somebody pointed out something with that last episode. They pointed out that there was no Poto Rota Player's Pro Tip of the Day in that episode. They were wondering if that was my trimming things down, making subtle changes. No, it wasn't. I'm kind of glad that you brought that up, because that's an important part of the show. That's like one of the key things that I do, but I wasn't feeling 100%. I was feeling okay, but I had COVID when I recorded that episode. And I got tired very easily, which is also why I probably ran pretty quickly. And I just simply left it off the script when I was writing the script. I completely forgot the Poto Rota Player's Pro Tip of the Day. So I'm going to drop that on you right now. Here is last episode's Poto Rota Player's Pro Tip of the Day.
Oh, yeah.
So, what is a Poto Rota Player's Pro Tip of the Day? I'm only telling you this once. I'm not going to tell you it again when you get one at the end of this episode. It's basically a pro tip. Whether you want to take that definition to heart or not, it could be something good. Or pro tip, it could be something not very good. It could be something right in the middle. So it could be legit. It could be shit. Could be eh. So what is today's player pro tip? It is for the game Sonic the Hedgehog. Did you know that you can confuse Sonic the Hedgehog into, well, almost practically trying to commit suicide? That's right. Did you know if you turn the game on, you don't press anything, the demo will begin to play with Sonic going through levels, as everybody knows. But if you hold C during one of these demos, Sonic will become confused and start to mess up and run into enemies and won't know where he's going and might fall into something that will kill him. Spikes, lava, whatever. Whatever's playing in that demo, rest in peace, Sonic the Hedgehog. That is last episode's Poto Rota Player's Pro Tip of the Day. So, in regards to this episode, this one was a little bit harder to write because of the fact that I was omitting Sonic the Hedgehog games, which, I mean, quite honestly, like, 3 of the games on this list probably wouldn't even be on this list if I included Sonic the Hedgehog games from the mainline Sonic series. I'm not counting spinoffs. So, it was fun going back, replaying some things lately, and as far as what I've been playing, that is literally it. I've been revisiting Sega Genesis games, and I didn't realize how, sadly, I forgot how nostalgic I am for that system. I was the Super Nintendo guy. I was the Nintendo, Super Nintendo, GameCube. Like, that was, those are, Nintendo was my jam. I was the Nintendo guy. Nintendo boy, Nintendo kid. And I had Sega systems. I just didn't play them as much as I did my Nintendos. And so it was easy for me to forget how nostalgic I am for Sega Genesis games. I didn't play the Master System all too much. I never even had the Master System. But I knew somebody that did. I know they had the Zapper. And yeah, it's crazy. And going back and playing some of these games, so let me tell you what I do. When you're talking about a wide breadth of games for me to rank. I visit probably 10 different legitimate sites that I deem appropriate for giving what their opinions are on video games and how they rank them. And I make a list of like 50 games, and I throw in games that maybe don't appear on those lists. And so then I'm staring at this giant list, and then I start to just whittle it down. Do anybody else's opinions match mine? You know, and if they do, those games kind of stick. And then I get my way down to about, you know, 15, and then down to 10, and then eventually down to 7. In doing so, I mean, there was a lot of games that I just have just super nostalgia for in revisiting them. I revisited 20 games for this episode, and in doing so, worked my way, cut it in half. Some of the games, not probably what most people would deem a very good Genesis game, but for me, it's just nostalgia. And I had to try to get rid of nostalgia. Sometimes I have to. Sometimes it doesn't escape me. There's going to be some games on this list that are legit top Genesis games, but for nostalgic purposes, I probably rank them a little higher than most people would. But, I mean, Altered Beast, Chuck Rock, Contra Hardcore, Kid Chameleon, Mega Bomberman, Mortal Kombat, even Mortal Kombat 2, Rystar, Strider, Tasmania, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, The Hyperstone Heist, Troll Jam and Earl, Vector Man. I will tell you right now, none of those appear in my top 7, but goddamn, it was close. It was close for some of those. And those are games that I'm all nostalgic for, including the 7 that you're about to hear on today's episode. Let's get into it. The top 7 Sega Genesis games, according to me. Golden Axe. Golden Axe is a side-scrolling beat-em-up hack-and-slash arcade video game released in 1989 by Sega for the System 16B arcade hardware. Makoto Uchida was the primary developer of the game and also was responsible for the creation of Altered Beast. Several ports of the game were created, most notably for the Mega Drive and Genesis, released in North America and Japan in December 1989, and in the EU almost a full year later in November of 1990. Progress is made through the game by fighting through Death Adder's henchmen, including men armed with clubs and maces, skeleton warriors, and knights. Players are able to attack using their weapons, jump, and cast spells that hurt all enemies on the screen. The force of this magic depends on the number of bars of magic power you currently have available. The bars are filled by collecting blue magic potions, attained by kicking little sprites who then drop the potions. These sprites appear during regular levels and during bonus stages in between levels. Now, when I say sprites, I'm not talking about like little boxes of 16-bit sprites that just show up on the screen. I'm talking about sprites are actual like little elven characters with top hats, almost like the Minish, in my opinion, from Zelda Minish Cap. So that's what I mean by sprites, if you're not familiar. The male warrior Axe is able to cast earth spells. The dwarf Gilius casts lightning spells, and the female warrior, Tyrus, casts fire magic. Each character has a different number of maximum magic bars and varying ranges of attacks. Various rideable monsters are found within the game as well. These can be ridden when the enemy rider is knocked off or if one is found dormant. The least powerful steed is known as the Chicken Leg, which first appeared in Altered Beast, which can be used to knock down enemies with a swipe of its tail. The more powerful Blue Dragon and Red Dragon, which can either breathe fire or shoot fireballs, is found later in the game. In addition to the main quest, some home versions of the game included Dual Mode, a survival mode type game that pitted players against increasingly powerful foes in consecutive rounds of play. This mode also featured a two-player one-on-one option. The Genesis / Mega Drive, I'm just going to always refer to the Genesis as the Genesis. I mean, this actual system as the Genesis. I might throw in a Mega Drive going forward, but this is really all about the Genesis. That's what I had. That was the North America console. This version remained largely faithful to the arcade game, adding an additional level to the aforementioned dual mode, along with a new ending. A one-player-only version was later re-released on the Sega Mega CD as part of the Sega Classics collection, with new Red Book background music and new voiceovers. The Genesis version was later released in other compilations, Sega Smash Pack, Sega Genesis Collection, Sonic's Ultimate Genesis Collection, and, oh, the Genesis port is also available on the Virtual Console. The arcade version, by the way, which slaps, is also on the Virtual Console and Xbox Live Arcade. A port of the game was released on PlayStation Network in July 2011 and was available for free to play for PlayStation Plus users. I mean, this one was close. Because of the nostalgia factor that I previously spoke about, I admit, it did play a role here. That's kind of why it's on my list, but I honestly couldn't decide when making the list if Altered Beast should be here instead. Which means that, well, I mean, if I were to say so, Altered Beast would probably be number 8 then. But one of the two just had to make the list, as both titles were, back in the day, pretty much prerequisites for owning a Sega Genesis. If you had one or the other, your friends found it awesome, you could play a kick-ass arcade game at home. But Golden Axe is just more faithful to the arcade original, and more enjoyable to play overall than Altered Beast. It really may not be a top 10 game for the system on other lists, but in terms of bringing what became an arcade classic home, it definitely ranks high for me in what is really a good example of how polished a port of this kind could be back in the day when most of them were watered down. That's simply all I can say. Golden Axe, number 7 on my list today. Unfortunate rhyme.
6.
Disney's Aladdin. Aladdin is a game for the Sega Genesis, designed by Virgin and released in November 1993, based on the Disney film of the same name. Go figure. The platformer had remarkably fluid graphics for the time through the use of cell animation. 5 original compositions and 5 arrangements from the movie were composed by Donald S. Griffin at the request of Virgin's audio director, Tommy Tallarico, who did the Genesis instruments and incidental transition music. Unlike the SNES version, the Genesis version was worked on by Disney animators under the supervision of Virgin's animation producer Andy Lucky and Virgin animators Mike Dietz and Ian Friedman. It should be unsurprising, therefore, that the series of Disney games on the Genesis in the early 1990s capture the mood of classic Disney animation better than any before, or quite frankly, any since. This was achieved by use of Digicel process, developed at Virgin Interactive by David Perry, Andy Astor, Mike Dietz, Andy Lucky, and Dr. Stephen Clark Wilson. The process successfully compressed the data from the animator's drawings into the limited processing capacity for the Sega, Genesis, Mega Drive. The game mostly involves killing enemies with basic swordplay and jumping across ledges. Several levels were very different, including one level where Aladdin must escape from the Cave of Wonders on carpet, and another where he must jump across the Agrabah's rooftops. The game featured very few bosses, actually. And the player controls Aladdin, who must make his way through levels based on locations from the movie. From the streets and rooftops of Agrabah to the Cave of Wonders, as I had mentioned, and the Sultan's dungeon to the final confrontation in Jafar's palace. The Sultan's guards and also animals of the desert want to hinder Aladdin in his way. He can defend himself with his sword or by throwing apples. Next to apples, Aladdin can also collect gems, which can be traded for lives and continues with merchants. Finding genie or Abu icons enables bonus rounds. The Genie Bonus Round is a game of luck played for apples, gems, or extra lives. Blink. Blink. Just going to throw that in there. Genie Bonus Round. Blink. In a Boo's Bonus Round, the player controls the little monkey and has to catch bonus items that fall from the sky without touching any of the unwanted objects like rocks and pots. So, the genesis at this point was aging. And like with most retro systems at the time, sometimes really good-looking games came out near the end of the system's life cycle. Developers pushed the limits, knowing what came before, and Aladdin here is no exception, of a game that proved that the Genesis still had life to pump out. The game was pretty faithful to the movie, and this version of the game, as stated earlier with the direct involvement of Disney animators, looked beautiful and played smoothly. The animation was like flowing melted butter. You could better explore the levels in this version, and the soundtrack is top-notch. It may have some pacing issues, and the difficulty is off-balance, but hey, Aladdin has a sword in this one, so that makes everything better, right? It is one of the best Disney platformers ever made, and this version of Aladdin is the best. It is the Genesis version. It's a good time, and it falls at number 6 today.
5.
Earthworm Jim. Earthworm Jim is a 1994 run-and-gun platform game developed by Shiny Entertainment featuring, spoiler alert, an earthworm named Jim, who wears a robotic suit and battles the forces of evil. The game was released for the Sega Genesis in North America in October of that year, and then in November in the EU. The game plays as a 2D side-scrolling platformer with elements of a run-and-gun game as well. The player controls Jim and must maneuver him through the level while avoiding obstacles and enemies. The player can use Jim's gun as a method of shooting enemies or his worm body as a whip for whipping enemies. The whip move also allows the player to grab a hold of and swing from certain hooks in the game. Some levels have additional requirements beyond merely getting to the end of the level. For example, for the level For Pete's Sake, that involves making sure that the computer-controlled Peter Puppy character gets through the level unharmed, which is accomplished by whipping him to make him jump over pits and defeating enemies before they can damage him. Failure to do so results in Peter lashing out at Jim, taking away from his health. It is very, very rage-inducing at times. Levels commonly culminate with a boss battle. The game incorporates a large variety of villains in the boss battles, including Cycro, Queen Slug for a Butt, Evil the Cat, Bob the Killer Goldfish, Major Mucus, and Professor Monkey for a Head, exclusive robotic chicken. Some of the best character names in all of video game history. Two villains made their only appearance in this game, Chuck, a junkyard man with a tendency to vomit bizarre objects, and Doc Duodenum, a crazed organ of a giant alien. In between most levels, a racing level called Andy Asteroids is played, and unlike the rest of the game, it places the viewpoints behind Jim. The player must direct Jim on his rocket in a race against Cycro through a tube-like structure while collecting items and boosts and avoiding asteroids. If the player wins, the next level is started instantly. If the player loses, a boss fight against Cycro must be won in order to progress to the next level. Other variations in gameplay occur over the course of the game as well, such as competitive bungee jumping in a fighting level, and an underwater maze that must be traversed both within a time limit and without crashing too many times. I fucking hate underwater levels in games. But you want to know, aside from that, how good of a game Earthworm Jim is? Well, at the time, EGM gave it the Genesis Game of the Year in 1994, and GamePro gave it a perfect score. It was ported to almost everything after the original release on the Genesis. It spawned a franchise. And even though Earthworm Jim didn't become the new mascot for a console, he is a gaming pop culture icon. It's going to be interesting to see what Intellivision does with this IP now that they have sole rights and exclusive use for Earthworm Jim. May he finally be an official mascot? Well, if the Amiaco comes out, maybe, but my fingers are slowly uncrossing. Anyway, back to the Genesis version. It's just a damn fine game. The game has fluid animation featuring a hand-drawn style that was unusual for 16-bit releases of that time. It actually felt similar to a game like Donkey Kong Country for the SNES, but in a different way artistically, obviously. This was really Genesis' innovative counterpart to the SNES classic, in my opinion, and is simply the best platformer on the Genesis since the OG Sonic the Hedgehog. The levels are long, but they are fun. The music slaps, and as warped as it can be, the humor is on point. It was a game made by gamers, for gamers, it shows, and some of the other ports may have been more polished, but the original Genesis release is where it all got started. It's where it is, Earthworm Jim. It's at a slimy number 5 on my list today. Echo the Dolphin. Echo the Dolphin is the original video game created by Ed Annunziata, which started the Echo series. The game was developed for the Sega Genesis console and released in December of 1992. Additional versions of the game were later released for Sega CD, the Master System, Game Gear, Microsoft Windows. In a nutshell, the point of the game is to save marine life that disappeared while you were off doing tricks, now leaving Echo to his own devices. Most levels consist of having to find and reach an exit. Usually there are obstacles such as barrier glyphs that impede the player's progress and have to be removed. In other cases, the player will have to solve puzzles or fight a boss. The exception of the battle with the Vortex Queen, upon starting a level, the game will give the player a password that can be used to return to that level at any time. With the exception of the last fight, the player has infinite continues. All levels are arcade style. It must be cleared in one try with no checkpoints present. The player has two bars to be mindful of here, health and oxygen. Running out of health automatically kills Echo and forces the player to restart the level. Health is depleted upon taking damage from enemies and hazards, while oxygen is generally depleted the longer Echo stays underwater. If Echo's oxygen bar runs out, his health bar will begin to deteriorate until he surfaces for air. Breaching will automatically restore Echo's oxygen bar, while simply just poking his head out of the water will restore his oxygen at a gradual rate. Later in the game, though, however, Echo will be granted infinite oxygen by the asterite. Health can be restored by eating fish, swallowing bubbles from certain shelled ones, or singing to an invincibility glyph. Late in the game, the asterite will grant Echo an ability which gradually automatically restores his health. However, this ability is unavailable during the fight with the Vortex Queen. Echo can be instantly killed by crushing hazards such as moving rocks and chunks of ice, or by being swallowed by the Vortex Queen. Echo will not take damage while being empowered by an invincibility glyph, however, he will still be vulnerable to crushing hazards. Interesting background on the game's development I wanted to kind of just share here. Annunziata had difficulty getting Sega to accept his main concept of Echo the Dolphin as a video game. After pitching the idea repeatedly for over a year to a rather cold reception, Annunziata eventually decided to transfer to EA for a better paying job. When Sega asked what it would take to keep him with the company, he accepted his request for funds and a team to develop Echo Prototype. The prototype spent 6 weeks in development. Upon seeing the prototype, Sega discreetly and quietly approved the game for full production when it appeared on their production plans. The game spent 10 months in development. Throughout the game's development, Ed repeatedly fought with Sega and won the battle for total creative control. And now, why do I think this is one of the Genesis' best titles? Well, if you know me and my comments here, see the previous game, or on the other shows or forms of media that I've appeared on, you may be surprised that this is on my list at all. Because I hate games with water. I hate games with swimming. I hate fishing games, so by default, I kind of hate fish. I really should hate this game. I don't like the claustrophobic feel of underwater swimming levels a game brings me while your character is running out of air. I mean, wow, I really, really should hate this game. But amazingly, I don't. And that's all in thanks to, in part, the fact that the game can be strangely calming at times. It is beautifully rendered and smooth, and the music can be atmospheric. It really brings that level of hatred from me down a few notches and makes this game overwhelmingly tolerable. And a game like this simply was never done before, and it really is one of the most unique games ever developed. Also, surprisingly, the game controls nice and tight as well. Here's to hoping the series can get the revival that Anuzieta wants, because I think Echo would look great in this generation. Echo the Dolphin, number 4. All right, rolling right along, more than halfway through the list already. Coming up to the top 3 Sega Genesis games of all time. Going to take a swig of water. All right, let's get right into it. 3! Castlevania Bloodlines. Castlevania Bloodlines is an action-adventure platform game developed and published by Konami for the Sega gaming console, the Genesis. It was released in North America and Japan in March 1994, and in Europe under the title Castlevania: The New Generation. It was the only Castlevania game released for that system. The game was promoted as a completely original vampire-themed action series at the time of its release, known as Vampire Killer, the game's Japanese title. A preview of the game that appeared in the back of the Ekumajo Dracula X Chino Rondo Strategy Guide referred to the game as Castlevania Gaiden. The game is notable for being loosely tied to the Dracula novel written by Bram Stoker. Castlevania Bloodlines holds true to the premise of the original game, but with notable additions. Making way through 6 linear stages is required, facing enemies and obstacles along the way. A boss is fought at the end of each level, although many bosses are usually also encountered when reaching its midpoint. Unlike most other Castlevania games that came before, the setting is not limited to inside and around Dracula's castle, and is spread out over several other locations in Europe as well. The game allows 2 characters to be controlled, each of which controls differently and can travel through different sections of a stage, only accessible to them. John Morris controls like the traditional Belmont, and thus wields a vampire killer whip, which can be upgraded 3 times instead of the usual 2, and has access to 3 separate sub-weapons. The 4th power-up changes the Vampire Killer into a flame whip and boosts the capability of the sub-weapons as well. Something that sets John, for their part, from most of his Belmont predecessors, is that he's able to whip downward while in the air, and can also use his weapon to swing from ceilings. Eric Lacard is more powerful character than John due to being slightly faster, and his weapon, the Alucard Spear, has a longer range yet does slightly less damage than John's whip. The spear can also be upgraded a total of 3 times as well, and Eric has access to the same additional sub-weapons as his partner. He is able to attack in 6 different directions, upward by lifting his spear and downward by performing a dive attack while airborne, as well as diagonally, although having to land on a horizontal hit before hitting diagonal on the D-pad is arguably of any worth. To TBH, Eric's 2 special abilities are twirling his weapon back and forth and using a huge leap of reach platform stationed right above him. Bloodlines is noteworthy for utilizing innovative special effects generated by the Sega Genesis, sometimes resulting in unique obstacles that had never appeared in any of the previous titles. Notable examples include the rotating Tower of Pisa and the upside-down rooms in Castle Proserpina. For myself, it was also mind-boggling to have a really great Castlevania game on a Sega console. Like some other franchises, such as Contra and Mega Man, at the time I just really associated Castlevania with Nintendo. So when this came out on the Genesis, I was like, what the fuck? Did Nintendo fuck up? Are we ever going to see a Castlevania game on a Nintendo system again? Like, what the fuck happened? I mean, they kind of sort of fucked up, but not really. I mean, it's game developers just branching out and seeing what other systems can do for their games, right? So even though it seemed like titles like those were exclusive to Nintendo, it just simply wasn't anymore. We did get Castlevania Dracula X on the SNES a year later. That we would come to find was a PC Engine exclusive to Japan a couple years prior. It just turns out that some of the better games in the series weren't released on a Nintendo console after all. And Bloodlines, for me, started that trend. I was amazed and felt that it was overall a better game than Super Castlevania IV. It isn't by any means a perfect game, but is a pretty perfect retro side-scrolling entry into the series, and I feel could only serve itself as well as it did being on the Genesis. There's not much else to say about this without beating a dead horse. It's a Castlevania game, after all, and it's just a really great one, and one of the best Genesis games of all time, in my opinion. Castlevania Bloodlines falls in at number 3 today.
2.
Dr. Robotnik's Mean Bean Machine. Well, there's not a lot to say about this one because it's just a puzzle game. But one of the best puzzle games ever, Dr. Robotnik's Mean Bean Machine, also known as Dr. Robotnik and His Mean Bean Machine in European countries outside of the UK, why I don't know, is a falling block puzzle video game based upon the Sonic the Hedgehog series developed by Compile and published by Sega for the Sega Mega Drive. Released in North America and Europe in November 1983, the game is based on the Japanese puzzle game Puyo Puyo, and Dr. Robotnik's Mean Bean Machine is basically just a skin on top of a Puyo Puyo game. It's also the only spin-off game in the Sonic franchise to take place in the Adventures of Sonic the Hedgehog universe, which ran during the game's release. The core gameplay of Dr. Robotnik's Mean Bean Machine is derived from, like I said, Puyo Puyo arcade game, but with altered visuals and rearranged music tracks. Here, the player takes the role of Has-Bean, whose mission is to rescue the kidnapped citizens of Beanville and defeat Dr. Ivo Robotnik. The objective in DRMBM is to obtain as many points as possible by grouping certain beans together as they fall down on the board from the top in groups of twos. One pair of beans will fall each turn. The beans themselves come in 5 different colors: red, green, blue, yellow, and purple. The player must attempt to arrange the beans in groups of at least 4 beans in the same color, and should they do this, the beans in the group will disappear. Both boards are 6 beans wide and 13 beans tall, meaning a board can hold a total of 78 beans. Math is your friend. Math never lies. If the board gets filled up with beans and the player becomes unable to move the next incoming pair of beans, the game ends. In a match between 2 contenders, the first to get a game over loses. That's about it. So why do I like it so much that I feel it's one of the best Genesis games of all times? Well, A, it's not Columns. And B, at the time I needed something else to play besides Tetris. It also involves Sonic, and it was a nice, fresh take on a puzzle game at the time that we'd never really seen before. And if it weren't for Sega slapping the Sonic skin on Puyo Puyo, I wouldn't know what the fuck Puyo Puyo is, and probably wouldn't be a fan of Puyo Puyo today. Puyo Puyo Tetris, anyone? Anyway, DRMBM is the second best Genesis game on my list, because it is the second best Genesis game of all time. All right, folks. Here we are, one last swig of water before we get into the top Genesis game of all time, according to me. It's finally here.
Yeah! Jesus fucking Christ, it's about time!
One.
Streets of Rage 2.
Thank you.
Streets of Rage 2, released in Japan as Bare Knuckle 2, the Requiem of the Deadly Battle, is a side-scrolling beat-em-up published by Sega for the Genesis and released in December 1992 in North America, and then in Japan and Europe a month later. It is the second game in the series as the sequel to Streets of Rage. Like the OG, one or two players fight against waves of enemies while picking up weapons and items along the way. Along with returning characters Axel Stone and Blaze Fielding, the game introduces two new characters, Max Thunder, a slow-moving but powerful wrestler, and Eddie Skate Hunter, known as Sammy Hunter in the Japanese release, the brother of previous games Adam Hunter, who can move around quickly with his rollerblades. In addition to standard attacks, which have been expanded from the previous game, each character can perform a unique blitz attack by double-tapping a direction before attacking. Replacing the police car attack from the previous game, each character can perform special attacks which can deal extra damage, or attack enemies from all directions at the cost of a player's health. Along the main campaign, two players can also fight each other in a game's dual mode. One of the reasons why this game is tops on the Genesis is that it looks gorgeous. Absolutely S-rank arcade quality here, everybody. Ancients Ayano Koshiro served as the lead graphic designer and one of the planners on the game design team. She designed the graphics, characters, combat mechanics, you name it, she did it. Her brother Yuzo, he was the lead music composer, also provided some input on the combat. The brother-sister team took inspiration from Capcom Street Fighter II, an arcade cabinet of which they had installed at the ancient office. The hit arcade video game influenced the combat system of Streets of Rage 2. Streets of Rage 2 was coded by the same programming team that did the original as well. To make it possible to add more features and additional memory cache, the programmers improved the Mega Drive cartridge specifications, or, like I said, in this case, Genesis. Speaking of music, the soundtrack is also slapping an arcade machine speakers on its asses. It was composed, as I stated earlier, by Yuzo Koshiro, along with three contributions from Motohiro Kawashima. It was composed using the outdated NEC PC8801 hardware alongside Koshiro's own audio programming language. According to Koshiro, he stated that for Bare Knuckle, he used the PC88 in an original programming language that he developed himself. The original was called MML, or Music Macro Language. It's based on NEC's BASIC program, but he modified it heavily. It was more a BASIC style language at first, but then he modified it to something more like assembly. He called it Music Love and used it for all the Bare Knuckle games. The soundtrack was influenced by electronic dance music, specifically house techno, hardcore techno, and breakbeat. The soundtrack for Streets of Rage 2 is considered revolutionary and ahead of its time for its blend of swaggering house synths, dirty electro funk, and trancery electronic textures that would feel as comfortable in a nightclub as is in a video game. It is a fucking slapping soundtrack. And when compared to the original, or other games of its kind, like Final Fight and Double Dragon, Streets of Rage 2 is the GOAT of retro beat-em-up brawlers. The sprites are huge and detailed, and quite honestly looks like something that would have churned out on the SNES with the colors popping as well. It was overall a fair game, but fanatical in making some movesets maybe a little bit too powerful. But damn, they feel good to pull off. And it is some of the best two-player fun you could have. I'm still a fan of the series to this day, and I can't say the same for the other games of its kind in this genre. Aside from playing some Double Dragon for the NES when recording that episode, I just don't revisit that franchise at all. And with Double Dragon and Final Fight, I could honestly care less if we ever see another entry from those games in those series. Yes, I'm a Streets of Rage fanboy. So there may be bias in me placing this game as high as I did, but one can't argue that it is not one of the best Genesis games ever. It really is the best on the Genesis, the best in the series, and the best fighter that isn't on a Neo Geo system. Streets of Rage 2, number one Sega Genesis game of all time. All right, so that's going to do it. That was the list of the top seven Sega Genesis games, according to me. You can fight me on it, Streets of Rage 2 style, if you want. But before we go, before we sign off for this episode, you get another Poto Rota's player pro tip of the day.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, I forgot the last one. So you had that one up top of the show. So here is the pro tip for the day. It is for Echo the Dolphin. And bringing you today's pro tip is Suwamee, the double blowhole dolphin. Suwamee, can you please tell our listeners what your pro tip for Echo the Dolphin is? Wow. Suwamee, shit, thanks. I wish I would have had that tip when I played the game. Holy shit, that is a retro gaming secret if I have ever heard one. Honestly, I'm blown away. No pun intended, Suwamee. But I hope you all find that tip super helpful when you play through Echo the Dolphin. It is one of, I've never heard that before. I don't think you can find that tip anywhere. It's, holy shit. Mind blown. So, yeah, that's going to do it for this episode of the Retro Rankings podcast. There's another one brought to you by Potation Rotation. Again, if you want to email us about anything you heard today or have an episode suggestion, please email potationrotation@gmail.com. Visit us at potationrotation.com for our social media links to Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. The merch shop is there as well. And of course, links to our gaming, reviews, and vlog channels on YouTube. Please don't forget to leave a rating for us. It would be appreciative, mean a lot. We do love you listening. And I thank you, and I'll see you guys next time. Later.